This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way the doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what the New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your hunger strike of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. That's Outshined by Soundgarden. This week, we're going to do a little bit of celebration of the lives of two singers who died way too young. Obviously, Chris Cornell of Soundgarden, who died on May 18th. And then last week, Chester Bennington of Linkin Park, who died on July 20th. Two singers from different generations, but with a lot of similar values in terms of their singing and in terms of what they were interested in musically, and who had a really, really outsized impact, and who actually had more to do with each other than they might seem at first glance. So this week, we're going to do Popcast in two sections. First, I am joined by all things rock expert Corey Groh.
Hello.
Later, I'll be joined by Hanif Abdurraqib, a music critic and poet, who will be talking to me about the deep feels of Chester Bennington and Chris Cornell singing. Corey is the senior writer for RollingStone.com, but I remember reading Corey in Decibel. Is that right?
That's right.
In Revolver.
That's right.
So, you know, Corey's been about this life for quite some time.
Yep.
You know, don't worry about the Rolling Stone mainstream. You know, go get the deep cuts. Go get the 7 inches. Corey's been out here for quite some time. Corey also wrote obituaries for both Cornell and Bennington. And so I thought it'd be great to have you here today to talk a little about their influences individually, but also in some bigger picture stuff. So let's start with Cornell. So let's talk about the early part of Soundgarden, because I feel like the Soundgarden that most people know and love is this sort of like very big, florid, loud band.
Yeah.
It didn't necessarily start in that exact same way.
Chris Cornell was never happy with being labeled metal, or some of the other bands maybe liked being metal, but they had this weird fusion where they tried to play punk, but it came out metal. So when you listen to like their first album, Ultra Mega OK, there's this really heavy like Beyond the Wheel song where Chris is going through three different octaves and the band is just playing these really sludgy riffs that maybe are Sabbath-y. There's all these weird rhythms. And it's just very unwieldy, and that's kind of maybe the punk thing. And, you know, they did another album, too, that was even more of a polished metal album, which was Louder Than Love, which we ended up putting on our 100 Greatest Metal Albums list for Rolling Stone.
Right.
Just because it's just this, it's a powerhouse. And
right.
It's one of these records.
But again, it's also not really a metal. It's like not a classic metal record.
It's, yeah, it doesn't sound like Metallica.
Right.
You know, it's very, I don't know, punishing in a different way. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? There's a rhythm to it. You know, that's the thing about Soundgarden is they always had these fantastic rhythms, and Chris somehow just fit his voice over that in the most beautiful way.
The thing about Chris Cornell, certainly a bona fide rock singer, but I felt like had a lot of patience for and curiosity about soul. Even the way that I found that he would like riff vocally had some more in common sometimes. And I'm not talking about late period Chris Cornell. I'm talking even screamy Chris Cornell had this kind of like creaminess to him.
Yeah. For as much as rock fans love to maybe don't like Mariah Carey so much, he did melisma better than, than a lot of R&B singers. And yeah, that soulful thing. He was really, he could take a song and just dive into it, you know?
So when do you feel like the band really came into its own? Because obviously you have that first album is 88 or 89.
88, yeah.
So we're talking, and it's Seattle, but we're not in breakout Seattle
yet. Right.
We're in germinal Seattle.
Right.
When do you think that they really came to the fore and really announced themselves? And also, how were they viewed at that time as compared to everything else that was happening?
They were viewed as leaders of Seattle at the time. You know, this was obviously before Nirvana really took off, and this is, you know, before Pearl Jam. I mean, in a way, Chris Cornell put together Pearl Jam, which is another conversation.
Right.
But yeah, they were this sort of just crazy punk band. They were the first band to sign to a major label. People saw all this potential in them. I don't think that they found their real groove, though, until Bad Motorfinger, at least when people think of Soundgarden, that was 1991. And that was actually a symptom, in my opinion, of Temple of the Dog, which was this side project that came about in between the earlier raw stuff that we were talking about and then Bad Motorfinger. And that was – Chris basically decided to do this side project in tribute to Andrew Wood, who was his roommate, who had died. And he was just so – overwhelmed by it, he wrote all these songs. And he got together with some of the bandmates that Andrew had played in Mother Love Bone. And he found another guy.
Little guy.
Yeah. Who could sing along with it. And that was Eddie Vedder, of course. And basically, the drummer from Soundgarden played on it. And what's funny is the lineup of Pearl Jam now, this is all those musicians went on to play in Pearl Jam. The lineup of Pearl Jam now is a Temple of the Dog without Chris Cornell.
Right.
But he decided to push himself into writing these more accessible pop songs, or maybe they just came out that way. And once that started flowing, you started hearing that a little bit more on Bad Motorfinger.
Outshine, which we played at the top, is from Bad Motorfinger.
Right.
Let's maybe listen to another Bad Motorfinger song. Maybe Rusty Cage?
Rusty Cage is great.
Yeah, let's listen to Rusty Cage. Okay, so this is 1991, and like in my mind at the time, other things were happening in Seattle that were more interesting.
Uh-huh.
This is sort of this is something I feel like we want to talk about a little bit later in the podcast, which is about how lived experience and memory end up sometimes being at odds with each other.
Right.
So at the time, how were they perceived at the sort of germ moment of Nirvana and Pearl Jam and other bands that were being taken maybe a little bit more seriously by the rock establishment?
Well, they were part of, they were considered part of a scene.
You know, critical the, establishment, I should
right,
say.
Yes.
I should say critics. Those lames, wild lame critics.
Who are these people?
Seriously. Super L on the
forehead. Always getting it wrong.
Yeah.
But Soundgarden, you know, just being part of the Seattle thing and also being name checked in interviews by Nirvana and Pearl Jam were just this band that it came come about with them. And I think that people just saw it, looked at them maybe as scene elders a little bit, but they weren't quite, they didn't have quite the instant success of Nirvana. So they were just seen as part of the Seattle scene. I think in hindsight, that's pretty unfair.
Oh, of course. But even at the time, you like you remember looking at Cobain from an aesthetic perspective and sort of the emotional content that he was communicating through the aesthetics.
Yes.
And you look at Eddie Vedder, and it wasn't exactly the same, but it was sort of consonant with what Cobain was doing. Sometimes I would look at Chris Cornell, and I'd just be like, this guy could be fronting a 70s hard rock.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
could be in Led Zeppelin.
Gorgeous flamboyant hair, you know, really into the singing. Like, you know, the way that he would project his voice was so different. In my mind, he was much more of a, not a classic rock singer, but a classic rock singer.
Yeah.
Like, he's a much more traditional rock singer than anybody else from that scene. At the time, was it considered passé at all?
No, because it was part of the scene, you know. I don't think that people questioned Chris Cornell. And also, having come from that sort of metal world, I think that people were able to separate the image from the sound, you know what I mean? Soundgarden had the sound that didn't sound like, you know, I'm trying to think of what was popular at the time. I mean, the biggest band in Seattle probably before them was Queensryche. You know, they didn't sound like Queensryche.
They didn't sound like Queensryche.
They might have had the hair, but yeah.
Gonna get a lot of emails about Queensryche. Love to hear. Everybody email me your favorite Queensryche song. No Googling.
Yeah.
So Bad Motorfinger was a legitimate breakthrough.
Yeah.
Like a legit, like an actual mega success. And again, what always struck me at the time was it felt like a mega success up against these other mega successes that seemed more ambivalent about their success.
Right.
Whereas
Soundgarden wanted that success.
That's what I'm saying. You could feel the bravado in
they
this
were
records.
That first band to go for the major label. Yeah. You know, they were ready for that. They'd been working towards that. You know, I did an interview with Kim Thayil once, you know, when this reissue of Bad Motorfinger came out, I guess last year. And he was just like, we were kind of blindsided by it all. We were swept up in the whole scene thing. We didn't think too much about it because we'd been here, you know, we'd been doing this.
Right. As a musical statement, do you feel like that's the best Soundgarden record?
In some ways it is. It's one of these things where it's really, really strong on the first half and it kind of falls apart a little bit on the second half. I think that
just like America.
Yeah, no, Super Unknown. Super Unknown is maybe a more consistent record. I tend to go back more towards Louder Than Love because I've just been on a kick on that record.
Sure.
The whole metal thing, the list that we did.
Tell me about Cornell as a singer in that particular time. Like I said, there's a real bravado to the voice. I always loved the way that he projected.
Yeah.
It's something that I think you saw less and less of throughout the 90s.
Yeah.
In many ways, he was one of the last of the 70s and 80s hard rock stars who were just like, we're the sexiest guys in the room.
Right.
And Cornell was like, yeah, I'm about that life. And everybody after him was like, yeah, no, we don't. We just look inside and talk about our feelings. Is that how he felt to you at the time?
Yeah. As a singer, what I liked about him when you compare him to Kurt and to Eddie is he had a better handle on dynamics.
Yeah.
You know, he could sing softly, and I think that came after that Temple of the Dog thing. He could sing softly, and then he would just totally banshee wail. You know?
Right.
I don't want to forget Lane Staley in the conversation,
sure, of course
too. He always sounded like he was gargling acid, you know, whether he was singing soft or whether he was singing loud. And it was brilliant, and no one can sing like him. And love Alice in Chains. But the thing that really pushed, that set Chris apart from all of them is he's the one that really sounded like, well, I don't know. I don't want to slight Eddie at all either, but he sounded like more like you're saying, like a traditional rock singer.
Yeah.
Eddie, you know, I was going to say he sounded more like a real singer in some senses, but Eddie obviously
An
amazing singer too.
Absolutely.
But Chris had he had that multi-octave range. He had this rage that would come through, but he also had a vulnerable side.
Yep.
And, you know, that all came through in different ways in each of those bands, but I feel like he segmented
and also like for not for nothing, like his sexiness was like classic. It was not like complicated, it wasn't counterintuitive.
Yeah.
It was just like, no, just here's a guy who just dresses, He's just like wearing beautiful garments and just like beautiful hair, and he just looks great.
Yeah, I had a girlfriend in high school that accidentally ordered a Soundgarden thing from BMG and didn't have any idea who they were, and then just like, oh my God, he's so hot. And she became like the biggest fan. They became her favorite band.
Oh my God. Oh my God. How long did that relationship last, Corey?
Long enough.
So 3 years pass.
Yes.
Between that record and the next record,
mm-hmm.
which is super unknown. What's happened in those 3 years? Let's try to like, a lot's happened in those 3 years. So well, like, talk that, through kind of what was going on.
That's just when the scene exploded. There's that video, 1991, the year punk broke, but it really broke in 92. Mm-hmm. You know, that's when Nevermind really took off. It wasn't really 91.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, that's when rock radio started changing. That's when the Queensrÿches of the world were getting a little bit less airplay than they were.
Right.
And all the Seattle bands, you know, were getting this attention on MTV. You could see a Melvins video on MTV, you know.
Strange times. heady times.
Yeah, and it just got bigger and bigger. So by the time Super Unknown came out, there was genuine anticipation on a major level for this record.
Right.
You know, and the first single was Spoon Man.
So it's the first single was Spoon Man, but that is not the song that this album is best known for. How about we listen to a little bit of Spoon Man and then a little bit of what people know?
Right.
So we're going to give you some Spoon Man and then we're going to give you some Black Hole Sun.
Come wash away the rain.
Now that you've heard those songs back to back, you can understand something of the conundrum of this particular moment in rock music history. Because I think if you were a casual listener of even just of pop music, not of rock or grunge specifically, you would listen to Black Hole Sun and you would think, is this band hard? I don't know. Is this band right. like, I don't know. Is this band Queensryche? Like, who knows?
Right.
But, you know, one of the things that made Soundgarden so effective was Cornell could sing either kind of song or any number of kinds of songs with kind of this similar, almost like a pinpoint effectiveness.
Yeah.
And I think what saves a song like Black Hole Sun is that kind of like basso profundo that he kind of like,
yeah,
wash away, you know, like yeah. really, it's like coming from like
dramatic.
It's coming from the diaphragm, like the real diaphragm stuff. And so I remember at the time feeling like, are they the kind of, not the Queensryche, that's a terrible thing. I don't wish that on anybody. But like, are they going to be the kind of like the big blousy ballad band out of this universe? It didn't turn out that way.
No.
But it did for a moment feel like that could happen. What did Black Hole Sun represent in the bigger picture in 94?
Well, I think it was like video, I could be wrong, but I think it was like, it was a video of the year. It was
huge. For sure. I mean, it was certainly on MTV, like every 16 minutes.
Everywhere. And it was just, it was just a rock song. This is the funny thing about grunge. When people talk about grunge and they talk about Seattle, is grunge doesn't really have a sound. And when they put out Black Hole Sun, people still call them grunge, but it's just a really good mainstream pop rock song. Unlike like Spoonman maybe is a little dirtier, a little grittier.
Yeah.
But Black Hole Sun has that Leslie Cabinet, that little like weird psychedelic sound to it. You know, it you know, in another generation, it might have been the Rolling Stones that we were listening to, or the Beatles or something like that. And, you know, Chris was obviously a huge fan of the Beatles more than metal bands, you know.
Yeah, it is a very classic song. And again, I think singers of those other bands of that time in that generation couldn't have done that song.
No.
Maybe Eddie.
Yeah.
But like,
it would have sounded different.
It would have sounded different for sure. No one could have done it with that kind of like pure beauty the way that Cornell did.
Eddie can't screech the way that Chris did. That's the thing.
No. Eddie can do the low thing, but it's not going to.
Right.
It's not. No knocks. It's just, you know, we're all gifted with different skills.
Of course.
So after Super Unknown, whither Soundgarden at that point? Because I feel like most of the big records and the kind of most poignant stuff has happened between like 89 and 94. So tell me about where the band went and tell me about where Chris Cornell went.
They were still one of the biggest bands when they put out their next record.
Mm-hmm. That was 97, I think?
Yeah. 96, 97. Yeah, Down on the Upside.
Mm-hmm.
And they were still getting hits on the radio. They, you know, I think that you could have to fact check me, but I think it was platinum, maybe double platinum, something like that. It was a big record. It wasn't as big as Super Unknown was, but there were no slouches, and they toured a lot, and eventually they fell apart. And that's the story of bands.
Of everybody. Yeah, that's not in and of itself.
Right. And Chris did a solo record, and, you know, eventually that became his thing for a while, you know, and he went in different paths. But Soundgarden, they, for whatever reasons, they fell apart and they had to move on. And he decided to really branch out and do as much as he could with that voice of his and try as many things. Like that first solo record he did, Euphoria Morning, it was just this great rock record that's sort of been lost in the ages. I don't hear people talk about it as much anymore, but it was...
No, in a weird way, it was a little too close to the Soundgarden stuff. And I mean that both temporally and also maybe temperamentally.
Yeah.
Because you really don't think at least for me, and this could just be because of my predispositions, but when I think of a Chris Cornell solo record, I'm thinking the Timbaland record. You know, like I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying we should all celebrate that record necessarily. It's a very unusual and strange sounding record.
It's a great risk.
I wish y'all could see Corey's face when he said that. I wish I had a gif of Corey's face when he said that. I am going to agree with that assessment. Yes. But sort of thrilling in its own way, because that came out in the late 2000s, which I think is like late enough in pop music, just sort of as a category where nobody takes risks anymore.
Right.
Like you sort of filtered a lot of the uncertainty out of popular culture by the late 2000s. And here's a guy who's just like, nah, I'm going to do this absurd thing with a producer who's like, sure, what the hell? Like, why not?
I'm sure it was one of those things where they're just like, this is so crazy, it might just work.
I'm going to play one of these songs for the people. I do want to encourage people to listen to this record, not because I think it's good, but because I do think it represents a rare moment of kind of, I don't know, it's like one of those, like, we can do anything.
Adventurousness.
Yeah, like, we can do whatever. Like, so let's listen to one of these moments. So here's Sweet Revenge, and we'll be back in just a second.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Okay, so the one thing about Chris Cornell's Scream that was perhaps not unusual is it was a record that merged two traditions, which was a thing that in the 2000s was actually happening more often than not.
Yeah.
And so I want to use this as an opportunity to segue into the second part of our conversation, which is about Chester Bennington from Linkin Park. But to be fair, Corey, you did just bring up a good point. So before we shift, what did we overlook with Chris Cornell?
We overlooked Audioslave. You seem to be a little more tentative about Audioslave than Scream, which is interesting.
Yeah, that's it is interesting, right? That's wow. Yeah. I gotta work that out with my therapist. Chris Cornell, beautiful voice. Audioslave, not my favorite stuff.
No.
Not my favorite stuff, but very popular rock records.
It was huge.
I find them square. How do you feel about the Audioslave albums?
They were maybe a little more stiff than you'd expect them to be, especially, I mean, it's funny because they came out around the same time as Velvet Revolver, which was Scott Weiland and then Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
And you had these two weird, you know, amazing groups. Singers fronting these classic bands because Audioslave had Rage Against the Machine.
Yep.
And both of them felt a little off, but both of them were huge, and both of them had huge hits. And, you know, Cochise and, you know, going back, Audioslave, it was maybe a little stiff for the time, but, you know,
I always felt Chris Cornell was a better singer than the band was a good band. I thought he was, like, a disproportionately good singer for those songs.
Yeah.
That would always felt to me.
Right.
I'm not going to play an Audioslave song. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Any Audioslave fans out there, I'm sorry. We're going to go to Chester.
Sounds good.
The 2000s were interesting.
Yes.
The late 90s and the 2000s were interesting. Okay, so Chester Bennington was the singer of Linkin Park. Linkin Park, as I'm sure everybody knows, but just as a quick primer, was the most commercially successful and in many ways, I believe, most aesthetically successful of the rap rock slash new metal bands of the late 90s into the mid 2000s.
Yeah.
What set Linkin Park apart, in my mind, or at least what set them apart, rather, structurally, they did not unify the rapping and singing talent in one person, which is a thing that would happen in some bands.
Right.
They had Chester, who is a true rock singer, and then they had Mike Shinoda, who was basically a backpack rapper.
Yeah.
And they had songs that were part theatrical arena rock and part, again, kind of like high-energy backpack rap songs, and somehow found an overlap that at the time was extraordinarily popular and often critically maligned. I went back to listen to the first two Linkin Park records, and it's quite shocking how prescient those records are.
Right.
And how completely natural every decision that they made aesthetically is basically now part of the fiber, or has been made part of the fiber now of pop culture. So Hybrid Theory comes out in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
To your recollection, how was Linkin Park received in the rock world? Because I remember how they were received in the hip-hop world, but how were they received in the rock world?
It's funny. It's one of these things where when they first came out, they were seen as kind of one of these, just another band, because there was Limp Bizkit, there was Crazy Town, and they were another new metal band, Korn, of course, and Orgy, and there's a whole scene that's forgotten and nobody wants to talk about anymore.
Shouts to the Family Values Tour. Shouts to the Project.
I was there.
You got your t-shirts.
Yeah, I was working in a record store when Linkin Park came out, and then just seeing the turnaround and seeing the way that Hybrid Theory caught on with people was incredible, because we couldn't keep it in the store.
Yeah.
And that's
a diamond record, if I'm not mistaken.
It is, yeah. It's a diamond record. One of just a few in that decade.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to one of the big hits on that record. Let's listen to Crawling. And those bands from the perspective of, it's weird that these guys want to get hip hop in their rock. Like, that was obviously a dominant thread of conversation in like 1998 to 2002. But if you were just to do a version of this song that was just Chester singing, you'd be like, this is a hard ass rock song.
Yeah.
He's a very precise singer.
Yeah.
He's powerful. He's scratchy. There's maybe not a lot of bass in his voice, but he has the wail down. He's singing about it. Like, I kind of came up with this after I wrote my piece about him, but I was like, he's basically an emo singer.
Yeah.
Like, at least content-wise.
Yeah.
He's basically an emo singer, but doing it on this, like, very theatrical hard rock stage. And the more you listen to these early Linkin Park records, you realize just how ferocious a rock band. Like, take away all the sort of gimmickry and the kind of, like, sonic experimenting. You're like, oh, this is a legit hard rock band.
Yeah, and that's why they worked.
Yeah.
You know, that's why they lasted and Crazy Town didn't, because Crazy Town was a gimmick. And they, you know, Linkin Park.
Yo, what if Shifty Shellshock listens to the podcast? He might be coming for you.
I'm ready.
You ready?
I'm ready.
All right, Shifty, you heard it. You heard the challenge.
But with Linkin Park, they had been woodshedding the sound, I guess, since 97. They were originally called Zero.
Right.
With an X.
Before Chester's in the band.
Before Chester was in the band. And their singer left for different pastures.
Yeah.
And Chester came
And Chester
in.
Was kind of in like a post-grunge band, if I'm not mistaken.
They were called Gray Days.
Gray Days.
And they were a grunge band, because they were in 93, 94. They were in Arizona. They weren't in Seattle.
You know the fertile Arizona grunge scene. Yeah. You're aware. You know all those songs. You guys know the hits.
But yeah, I mean, that's where he came from, and that's why you can hear that. And I think that's also why Linkin Park has this vulnerability And Chester has this vulnerability that he put in his voice that you didn't hear from the bro-y Fred Dursts of the world.
Exactly. And that's what, again, I think it was so crucial that they separated out those tasks,
yeah,
the rapping and the singing. Because you had this struggle with the music of that era where you had racial credibility questions, you had,
right,
posturing, you had all these guys who were like, that Upski piece where it's like what the white boy means when he says yo, which is about,
right,
white rap kids in the 90s. But certainly you look at the cover of Spin in 2000 and you see like Fred Durst and you'd be like, oh my God, like what is happening here? And it was, I remember coming from the hip hop side, I was like, this is extremely vexing.
Yeah.
Like, this is really weird.
Yeah.
And like,
coming from the rock side, I can tell you that too.
Yeah, but also I was like, we're not claiming these guys.
Right.
You know, it was like, you know, like maybe you could claim Kid Rock because Kid Rock had theoretically been a rapper,
yeah,
at some point.
Yeah.
But for the most part, it was like, not it. And on your side, it was also like, not it.
Yeah.
And there were all these sort of like tortured cultural and racial intersections that were happening that no one had really parsed at that time. They still,
right,
felt strange and fresh and new. Linkin Park avoids a bunch of that because we have a guy who sings who doesn't then have to be like, I'm going to start rapping in this,
right,
like very affected bro-y style.
Yeah.
And the rapping is handled by someone who basically was like the third guy in Styles of Beyond or something, like just some like complete Fat Beats type indie rap group.
Yeah.
And so by doing that, I think that's not just why they lasted, but that's why they ended up, I think, having this longer credibility. Forget like success. I think they had credibility because I think you could really sign on,
mm-hmm,
to Chester as a rock star. And if you were a rap guy, you could be like, oh, Shinoda, yeah, he listens to what I listen to.
Yeah.
Even if he's not like the most elegant rapper in the world, like I know that his taste profile is like pretty consonant with my taste profile.
Right. And it's the same thing when you look at the whole band. They each sort of had their own representation. They also had their own jobs in the band that they did. Like Mike did the visuals,
mm-hmm,
and Mike and would collaborate with Brad, the guitar player, and they would work on most of the music together. Obviously, Chester did the lyrics, and he had a clothing line when they first started.
Oh, I got to cop that. Get that on,
yeah,
eBay.
Yeah. So they each had all had their own little silos, and for some reason, it's the only organization, the only corporation in America where having these big siloed
actually
things would work together.
Actually effective.
Yeah.
So Hybrid Theory is a it's a monster.
Huge.
In every way.
Yeah.
It's incredibly popular. It's a large sounding record.
Yeah.
And really like a thing that I think is admirable about the bands of that generation, there wasn't a lot of, I don't know if insecurity is the right word, but there wasn't a lot of like, should we be doing? Like, does this feel right? Does this feel right? It was just like, here's this new thing. We're dropping it at your doorstep.
Yeah.
The hell with you. Like, this is, we're selling out across the country. Like, we don't care if no, you know, like tastemaker people like it. I remember at the time thinking it was maybe a little bit cheeky of them to, instead of coming with a second album, coming with a remix album.
Right.
It was like a little on the nose.
That was also, every band was doing that at that point.
But it was still like weird.
Was weird, but
Korn did it too.
I think it was weird for everyone. I'm trying to say.
It was equal opportunity weird.
Yeah.
But okay, so Meteora is the next big Linkin Park record.
Yes.
That's not the remix record. That's an actual big record. That's the next one. I don't know. Is that Diamond? I don't know. It's popular.
It's not, but
it's many, many times.
It was huge, yeah.
It's many, many times platinum. Let's listen to Numb from Meteora. Okay, so it's 2003 and nu metal / rap rock / whatever is like starting to wane. This is maybe,
yes,
the last big, bold statement of that entire movement.
Yeah.
Linkin Park doesn't go anywhere.
No.
But of that movement, this is maybe the last thing where you can point to and be like, that's a major artistic position statement.
Right. Because then there was Chocolate Starfish, which killed Limp Bizkit.
Never heard that record. Things.
Yeah, well, you're lucky because that was another one that came out when I was at a record store.
I'm sure I have it in my storage unit somewhere.
But the thing about Linkin Park is they took that mantle. I've read where they said that they didn't necessarily want to make a record like Meteora when they did. They wanted to move on because, you know, the thing about that band is every record they made after that was fairly stylistic. Different.
Yes.
And they actually kind of caved a little bit to label pressure to make a record that could follow up Hybrid Theory. And in hindsight, it was the perfect thing for them because right. It kept them going. And that doesn't always work for bands.
See, guys, record labels are super.
Sometimes they're
super,
right.
They're your friends.
They can be.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is the next thing that they did after that was the Jay-Z collaboration, yes. Which was the right thing to do again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Jay-Z gave them that credibility where, you know, even more with rap, they kind of remixed their songs together. That was, you know, right around the mashup period of the 2000s.
Right. It's weird because it seemed actually weirdly Craven because of the mashup thing. I re-listened to Collision Course, of course, last week. And I was like, okay, I got this.
Right.
Yeah, like this all makes sense.
It actually holds up a little better than you might think without listening to it.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about Linkin Park is they were just so on trend. So they
very much so.
Yeah, they took that song "Numb" and they put it together with Jay-Z's Encore.
I feel like let's listen to a minute. Well, let's listen to the transition moment in "Numb" Encore. There are a couple, but like listen to one of the transition moments in "Numb" Encore.
What you made me do, look what I made for you. Knew if I paid my dues, how will they pay you? When you first come in the game, they try to play you. Then you drive a couple of hits, look how they wave to you. From R.C. to Madison Square, to the only thing that matters is just a matter of years. As fate would have it, Jay status appears to be at an all-time high. Perfect time to say goodbye. When I come back like Jordan, we're in the 4-5. It ain't to play games with you, it's to aim at you. Probably maim you. If I owe you, I'm blowing you to smithereens. Concept, I'll take one for your team. And I need you to remember one thing. I came, I saw, I conquer. For record sales, sold out concerts. Come on, nigga, you want this encore? I need you to scream till your lungs are sore. Come on.
I'm tired of being what you want me to be. Feeling so faithless, lost under the surface. Don't know what you're expecting of me. But under the pressure of walking.
The way that they got that together, it just is seamless, and it holds up.
And that's a lot of Shinoda on that, right? Like, terms of, like, the sort of, like, engineer, like, the sort of, like, the mechanism that making it happen.
That's Shinoda as a producer, yes, too. You can exactly. hear that. You can,
So after this, Linkin Park continues to put out records for the next 10 years. As recently as 2 months ago, Linkin Park had a number one record.
Right.
But they don't sound very much like the original Linkin Park records. You start to see, and this is actually why I was thinking hard about Linkin Park in the pantheon of true great rock bands, because I was like, oh, they're actually a dynamic, diverse band willing to go in unexpected directions. They can do conventional hard rock. They can do like a new wave record. They can do weirdly like a kind of like soft rock, half Depeche Mode thing.
Yeah.
They're all over the place in these next 3 to 4 albums.
Yeah. There's some sort of U2 like guitar that you can hear on like Minutes to Midnight. They were working with Rick Rubin, which I think is worth noting because what's funny about when you think of Rick Rubin production, at least in recent years, he's always kind of trying to push artists to go back to their roots.
Yeah.
In this case, he was pushing them to find this new sound or find something new within themselves. And they came up with a lighter sound and something about it stuck. They didn't lose their fan base. Their fan base
they grew with it.
Yeah.
It is the classic definition of like growing with your fan base.
Yeah, and it's this thing that you usually see in pop artists like Madonna or Bowie, where these artists can stay on trend and not lose fans. And it's a curious thing. And somehow Linkin Park managed to do that from rap rock, which
Right, but I think what it showed to me that they remain so popular is not just they held their fans, but they genuinely were perceived as a true rock. Like, these are fans of rock bands who stuck with them for 10. These aren't necessarily, like, fickle hip-hop fans who are like, ah, oh, we're on to the next sound or the next flavor or whatever. It's like you have Linkin Park lifers who are like, I like the old stuff that's a little bit harder. I like the new stuff that's a little bit softer. And the thing that is the constant, because obviously Shinoda as a vocalist gets marginalized on these later records. What's actually constant is Chester.
Chester.
That powerful, powerful voice.
Yeah. And he always wanted to try something new. And I think that that's maybe most evident on the latest record, One More Light, which is a pop record. And it's just not, it's like, no, like no bones about it. It's not a rock record in any way. And it was still a number one record when it came out.
All right, let's go out with a song from One More Light. The one that I feel the most strongly connected to is Good Goodbye, which is the record with Pusha T and Stormzy. But we'll play the Linkin Park parts of that song. So say goodbye. And thanks to Corey
for
coming and spending some time celebrating Chris Cornell and Chester Bennington with
us. Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Let me say goodbye to my demons. Let me say goodbye to my past life. Let me say goodbye to the darkness. Tell them that I'll rather be.
The Collision Course continues on Popcast this week for the second part of our tribute to Chris Cornell and Chester Bennington. I'm on the phone live from Chicago with Hanif Abdurraqib. What's up, Hanif?
What's up, John? How you doing?
I'm well. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us today. We've just spent about 30 minutes kind of going over the history of Soundgarden and Linkin Park and kind of assessing the commercial and creative impact of Chris Cornell and Chester Bennington as singers and as forces in the music business. You wrote about both singers on the occasion of their passing, and you wrote from a very different perspective. So I felt like in talking about the kind of feels associated with both singers, you were the guy I wanted to talk to. So let's start with Chris Cornell. Tell me a little bit about your relationship to him and his voice and his singing and kind of what that meant to you at the time of your life when that was happening.
So I think my most intense Chris Cornell memories are kind of past Soundgarden's heyday. And I know when I wrote about him, I wrote about specifically seeing the Black Hole Sun video when I was a kid and how it freaked me out and kind of introduced me to a rock and roll that could be kind of delightfully terrifying. But I think with Cornell, you know, I liked most his solo stuff because it was weird and kind of unacceptable for a lot of hardcore Soundgarden fans. Like when he put out that album with like Timbaland on it.
Oh, we definitely talked about that. Yeah, hell yeah.
It was very weird. Like, but you could also at that time see him play for pretty much nothing. You know, he would like tour and do these shows, and like seeing Soundgarden is like a whole thing, but he would just like show up with acoustic guitars or like with a small backing band and play these like small clubs. And I saw him a bunch when he was kind of on his solo runs just because they were so cheap and I was like poor. And so I have this really odd but endearing relationship with solo Chris Cornell that I think a lot of people probably would find hard to understand because the music itself was like not at all, when compared to Soundgarden particularly, not at all that great.
Right.
But he seemed like so happy doing it.
But it also underscored something very particular about Chris Cornell, because in Soundgarden, Chris Cornell is this kind of kingly figure. He's, you know, he's a rock god. He's almost, I was saying earlier in the other conversation, in many ways, he is a holdover of the 70s and of the rock gods of the 70s and 80s. And certainly up against the other bands from Seattle of that time who were like much more ambivalent. Chris Cornell never felt particularly ambivalent in terms of his presence, his authority, his sexiness, all these things. They were real things. But I imagine solo Cornell also accessed the vulnerability, the soulfulness, all these other things that underpin that kind of like big theatrical rock presence, but don't get play in a band like Soundgarden.
Right. The cool thing about solo Cornell was that his versatility was so impressive that he could have been a I mean, I think I wrote this, he could have been a rock star in any era.
Yep.
You know, like from maybe like the 60s on. And the full pop, more globular experience was really fascinating. As someone who loves Soundgarden, who, you know, thought the world of Chris Cornell's ability, I mean, I would listen to him sing anything. You know what I mean? Like, you take him to the karaoke bar and just, like, run down the list. And I think that kind of versatility was really rare for a singer to come out of the era he came out of particularly. And he was so able to kind of continually transform himself in ways that I think a lot of bands, a lot of frontmen, a lot of members of those bands from those, like, early, mid-90s just couldn't do.
Well, they could do one kind of thing, those guys. And what's interesting about Cornell, in addition to what you say about him being able to sing any style or could have been a star in any era, I also think from a pure technical perspective, in terms of the shape of his voice, the kind of there was as loud as he got, there was always like kind of a soft, seductive kind of exterior around it. There was like a caress going on, even at like the toughest moments. That was something that I think a lot of the guys from his era and the era immediately before never really understood or never really had the facility for. But Cornell was always a little bit sensual, even in like the hardest of days.
I know that people, at least in my world, I mean the world of poetry and poetics, there's always a conversation about either raising the intensity of your voice without raising the volume, or raising the volume of your voice while continuing to keep the intimacy inside of it. And I think Chris Cornell was so good at a volume that still invited the listener close.
It's interesting to talk about him kind of in partnership with Chester Bennington. They were close friends. I don't think that they had loads in common vocally, but I feel like the fervor and intensity of the Believers in both of them are very, very strong and have a lot of consonance. You also wrote about Chester. A thing that I was very struck by when I went back last week and really listened again to the first couple of Linkin Park records. I think at the time, especially writing about hip hop at that time and coming at those albums more from like a structural perspective of like, what is this doing and why is this working? A thing that I maybe had not fully appreciated in the moment of Hybrid Theory or in the moment of Meteora was this guy's one hell of a rock singer, like a true, true rock singer. And when you go back and you listen to those records and then carry the thread through all the Linkin Park albums up until the most recent one, that's actually the one common thread I found in re-listening. It wasn't necessarily a production gesture or sonic approach. It was Chester is a strong, powerful, and versatile rock singer that really plays with emotion in a very tactile and palpable way.
Yeah, and I think the thing with Linkin Park too, especially on those first, I would say three albums, I think even though Minutes to Midnight, the third album, definitely kind of strayed. I think that's when they linked up with Rick Rubin for the first
yes.
time. Mm-hmm. And he kind of like pulled them out of
he's here to rescue. Pulled them out of the, Rick Rubin is here yeah. He's here to reduce you guys whenever you're ready.
But I think that Chester is so flexible, and he was so emotive through whatever their sound process took. Because I thought, and I was young, I mean, I was like coming into my own as a music fan when those first two albums came out, right? And they both sounded like nothing else I had gotten my hands on at the time. You know, it was before, I think, rap rock became this kind of comical thing. And it still felt really fresh. At least theirs did. And I want to say that I think I am of the belief that Mike Shinoda can rap.
It's this whole, it's a whole separate podcast, my guy.
Yeah. But I think maybe he could. I haven't heard much of his stuff.
Well, I referred to him on the previous part of the podcast, on the previous segment, I referred to him as the third member of Styles of Beyond. So that's kind of a compliment. I quite like Styles of Beyond.
That is a compliment.
I quite like Styles of Beyond. So, you know. Shouts to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think it worked. I think they played off each other so well for so long. It just worked really well.
And also, I think the kind of the division of labor was really important because Chester didn't have to rap. Shinoda didn't have to sing. So Chester could focus exclusively on delivering intense, ferocious emotion and not worry about the kind of other structural needs of the band.
He was like the emotional vehicle of the band, and Shinoda was kind of the tethering force that kept it from careening off the road.
I think I was maybe even a little caught off guard last week by the potency of the response to his passing because I felt like the level of emotional connection that people had with Chester was so strong. And I saw it, you know, on Twitter or Instagram or Tumblr. I saw it coming from so many different, not just generations of fans, but also different types of kids, different backgrounds. It was very, very striking how broad his appeal was and also how emotionally specific. And that's something that I think a lot of great singers struggle with. It's not, you can be popular, but you might lose your specificity. You might be specific, but you might lose your breath. Chester seemed like someone who was able to actually maintain that kind of tactile emotional connection at a very, very high level and broad scale.
Yeah, I was also surprised by how much he seemed to resonate with so many people. I think whenever a musician dies, there are points of it that, for me, or there are certain musicians where it is not surprising. I think Cornell was one of those. When Cornell died, I wasn't surprised by the response his death got. Bennington felt, because of how I came into him, because of when I came into him in my life, and because at that age, it didn't seem like anyone else older than me was into Linkin Park. You know, Linkin Park was taken seriously, but mostly it felt like only in my little bubble. I was surprised by the wide range of people who seemed to be touched by Bennington's work last week when I found the news.
Yeah, and out the news. Right, and people, like, obviously, look, we're in a time in pop music where it's not uncool to like pop, and like there's no shame left anymore. At least in many of the circles that we travel in, we try to avoid feeling shameful about the things that are our pleasures. But a lot of kids who I look, you know, if I were to look at their Instagram 99% of the time, I would never think, oh, you guys are really into Linkin Park. You guys are really into Chester Bennington. And like all of a sudden, all of these folks were bringing that to the fore. And it was I found it very moving. And it really made me think about him in a totally different way. So that was a powerful week for that.
Well, and it was interesting too, because I think Linkin Park hasn't felt, even though they still sell records. I mean, I think, you know, they're still a band that sells out shows.
And yeah, they had a number one album 2 months ago.
Had a number one album. But it feels like I cannot pinpoint now who their fan base is, right?
Because yep.
Everyone who loved them when I was young doesn't love them anymore. And I can't, you know what I mean? I can't put my finger on where their fan base, what their demographic is like. Like, I stopped listening to them aggressively after Minutes to Midnight, and that was like a decade ago.
Something that I think jumped to my mind when I was re-listening to Hybrid Theory and Meteora last week was all of those gestures on the album, and I mean more the production gestures and the ideological gestures, which at the time seemed gauche to some, or clunky, or uncertain, or overwhelming, they feel so obvious right now. You know,
right.
Time has been kind to that entire era. And listening to those albums, I was like, oh, this just sounds like the blueprint. Not Jay-Z's blueprint, but the blueprint for many things.
Thankfully, it did not sound like Jay-Z's blueprint.
That would be fire if that was my take. My hot take is that the most important albums of the early 2000s were Hybrid Theory and The Blueprint, and they were the same album. That's my take.
Hot take is that Collision Course actually very good.
I'll give it a B. I'll give it a B. But basically, that album, those first two albums feel incredibly prescient. And that I think maybe what's happened is a lot of young kids have just sort of naturally, through the bands that they like, have found their way back to Linkin Park as some kind of like alpha of that entire idea.
Bennington was such a once-in-a-lifetime vocalist. And so I think that there's something magnetic. He's kind of like Corin Tucker in that way, where, you know, you arrive at Sleater-Kinney mostly because there's this jarring voice at the front of it. In Linkin Park, yes, there were other things, but I think Bennington's voice was so unique and so unlike anything that had come before it, so that even hearing them now for the first time, I think folks are drawn in.
Yeah, it stings. It has a real sting to it. It's like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I think the thing that surprised me last week was so many people were so invested in the interior of the lyrics of Linkin Park and the emotion of Linkin Park. When I was younger, my first thing with them was just, this guy's voice is outrageous. And I'm drawn to that. But I do think that the lyrics have held up well. The, like, sentiment of Linkin Park has held up well.
To sort of tie it all together, when I thought about the emotional potency of these two singers, I thought that they were maybe parallel but not intersecting. But then last week I started Googling around. And I started watching the performances where they sang together. And there are a bunch of, on the Project Revolution tour in the late 2000s, there are a bunch of times where they got together and they sang Hunger Strike, Temple of the Dog. And I think we should go out on one of those performances. So Hanif, thank you so much for calling in today and talking about Chris and Chester. I appreciate it.
No doubt, John. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And we're going to go out with Hunger Strike, Chris Cornell, Chester Bennington. Yes, I am.
But I can't feel the powerless when my cup's already overfilled. Yeah. But it's on the table.
And that's our podcast this week. Thank you to my guests, Corey Groh and Hanif Abdurraqib. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, anywhere you get your audio content. You can email us any memories or favorite songs of Chris Cornell and Chester Bennington at podcast@nytimes.com. Our producer is Pedro Rosado. We're back next week.